Usually when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there's this expectation of precision. It's almost like engineering, right? You break your arm, the x-ray shows that jagged white line, and the doctor just points and says, there it is.
Right, it's completely binary, broken or not broken. It's a clean answer, and more importantly, I mean, it's comforting. We are wired to like things that are visible and easily categorized.
Yeah, we want to know exactly where the problem is. But then, you step into the world of modern infrastructure, you look at our energy grids, and suddenly that x-ray machine is just completely broken.
Right.
We are looking at a diagnostic landscape that is entirely murky.
Oh,
I mean,
absolutely.
think about it. If you flip a light switch in your living room and the bulb doesn't turn on, the point of failure could be the bulb itself. It could be the wiring in your wall.
Or a blown transformer down the street.
Exactly.
Yep.
Or it could be a catastrophic cascading failure at a centralized power plant, like 1,000 miles away.
It is the absolute definition of diagnostic muddy waters. I mean, our reliance on distant, unseen systems creates a fragility that we only really recognize when the screen goes black. The grid is this invisible tether, and most of us have no idea how strained it actually is until it just snaps.
Right. And that brings us to today's deep dive. Today is Friday, July 10th, 2026. And we are looking at a massive stack of internal documents, technical audits, and strategic blueprints from a conglomerate called Deriticular.
And it's worth noting these aren't just visionary pitch decks.
No, not at all. These sources span from late 2025 through the first half of this year. They cover heavy deployable industrial hardware, autonomous logistics, software, decentralized governance. I mean, if you've experienced grid instability, if you know the anxiety of rolling blackouts or waking up to read about another massive data vulnerability because a central server farm went offline, what we are unpacking today is going to fundamentally change how you view your own neighborhood.
It really is.
We are looking at a blueprint called Project Octagon, which aims to systematically replace those fragile centralized grids with autonomous, self-funding sovereign nodes. And I have to say, the sheer scale of these documents is wild. It reads like science fiction, but it's actual deployable industrial hardware that is live right now.
Yeah, and we need to be very precise about what a sovereign node actually means in this context, because Deriticular isn't just talking about backup generator or, a few solar panels on a roof.
Right.
These documents detail an ecosystem capable of running entire communities off their own localized waste, completely severed from the national grid.
Which is insane to even think about.
It is. It involves a fusion of heavy industrial hardware from a division called Agridot Energy, autonomous logistics from Curb Cars, the software architecture of their Rios operating system, and a decentralized governance framework called Deioswis. It is a massive paradigm shift in how human civilization operates.
It really is hard to wrap your head around the engineering tolerance required to pull this off. I mean, looking at these schematics, we are talking about running 1500-degree plasma reactors right next to delicate AI server racks, all governed by local networks.
Yeah, the thermal management alone is a nightmare.
But the philosophy underpinning all of this really caught my eye. The documents constantly contrast the legacy grid, which they call the death of the line, with their new model, which they call spherical resilience.
The death of the line is a brilliant way to frame the engineering flaw of the 1,000-mile failure model we live with today.
Yeah.
Because if you look at how the global infrastructure is built, it is characterized almost entirely by linear dependencies. You have a power generation station, usually burning natural gas or coal, or maybe it's a massive hydroelectric dam.
Right. Located hundreds of miles away from the population center it actually serves.
Exactly. And that electricity has to travel along highly vulnerable, exposed transmission lines. It gets stepped up to incredibly high voltages for travel, then stepped down at substations.
Okay, let's unpack this, because every single one of those step-up and step-down transformers is a massive point of vulnerability, right?
Precisely. If a single disruption occurs anywhere along that hundreds of miles long physical wire, that linear chain breaks.
Wow.
Whether that is a thermal event, like a wildfire melting the lines, or a kinetic event, like a tree falling during a storm, or even a cybernetic attack on a digital substation. Because everything is interconnected in a fragile sequence, that single break cascades into systemic grid paralysis. One severed line equals total darkness for millions of people.
It's exactly like a string of cheap holiday lights. You know the ones where if a single tiny bulb dies somewhere in the middle,
the whole string goes dark?
yes, and you're left pulling out every single bulb to find the one point of failure while the whole tree sits in the dark. The linear grid is basically a giant string of cheap lights.
That analogy holds up really well, but the reality is even more complex than that, because with the power grid, finding the dead bulb often requires dispatching physical utility crews across mountainous terrain in the middle of an ice storm. The legacy grid is a system built for terminal failure. It requires constant, massive intervention just to maintain baseline functionality.
Which brings us to their solution, spherical resilience. Instead of a single vulnerable line stretching across a continent, they are building a geometric hex mesh. I keep picturing chainmail.
That's a good visual.
Right. If you take a sword and cut one link in a piece of chainmail, the rest of the armor holds together perfectly. The network is designed to be redundant. The nodes operate in what Duraticular calls island mode. If the central government's grid collapses, or if the town next to you goes completely dark, your specific node just keeps right on functioning. It doesn't even blink.
Because it doesn't rely on a central heartbeat. And to prove this works, Duraticular is deploying Project Octagon. This is a global honeycomb network consisting of 8 interconnected primary nodes.
And they are deliberately stress testing this hardware in the most brutal, unforgiving environments on Earth.
Exactly. The logic is simple. If the hardware and the software can survive in these extremes without any external support, it can easily survive in a standard suburban or rural environment.
Let's look at the geography of this because it is fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Node 2, which they refer to as the brain, is located in the freezing tundra of Canada. Why put your primary software repository in sub-zero temperatures?
It comes down to thermal dynamics and the physics of the cold iron start. They are stress testing the physical brain of this network against deep freeze conditions. When a total winter power grid failure occurs, ambient temperatures can plummet well below zero.
And standard electronics are definitely not built for that.
Not at all. Solder joints become brittle and snap. Liquid cooling systems can freeze and rupture. When a machine cycles from freezing to operational heat, condensation builds up on the motherboards and shorts out the circuits.
Oh, wow. I didn't even think about condensation.
Yeah, it's a huge issue. So Node 2 is designed to prove that the system can boot up, manage condensation, heat itself to operational temperatures, and maintain the network's digital registry even when buried in snow.
And then, to prove they aren't just optimizing for the cold, they swing to the complete opposite extreme. Node 3 is called the Blast Furnace, and it's located in Phoenix, Arizona.
Where the ambient temperature regularly exceeds 115 degrees Fahrenheit, or about 46 degrees Celsius. Node 3 is their research and development headquarters, and it faces a completely different thermodynamic enemy, which is heat dissipation.
Right, because these sovereign nodes utilize high-density AI servers and high-temperature plasma reactors.
Exactly. If you are operating heavy compute and industrial manufacturing in the middle of a desert summer, your primary engineering challenge is cooling. They use Node 3 to test the thermal operational limits of their liquid cooling loops, heat exchangers, and battery cell structures.
Because lithium batteries degrade incredibly fast under high heat.
Very fast. If they can keep the entire system cool and functional in an Arizona summer, entirely disconnected from the grid, their thermal engineering is effectively bulletproof.
But the one that really caught my attention in these reports is Node 4. They call it the Green Industrial Engine, located in Kabum, Uganda. This is a massive 10-megawatt reference node. It is currently powering a 7,000-acre hemp industrial park and a regional AI compute cluster entirely off-grid.
And this is where we see the software and the hardware truly merge into a unified intelligence. What's fascinating here is that this isn't just about backup power. It's about distributed cognition. Node 4 isn't just generating power for tractors. It is processing data. The documents outline a mechanism called a swarm update capability, which utilizes federated learning.
Okay, let's pause there because federated learning is a term that gets thrown around a lot in AI circles. But how does it actually apply to a physical power plant in Uganda talking to a server in Canada?
It is a profound shift in network intelligence. In a traditional network, if you want AI to learn from data, you have to send all the raw data to a central server, train the model, and send the update back.
Which requires massive bandwidth.
Massive bandwidth, and it poses a huge security risk. Federated learning flips that. Let's say the AI managing the power routing at Node 4 in Uganda detects a novel cyber threat. Mm. Or perhaps it discovers a slightly more efficient algorithm for managing the plasma reactor's heat output based on the local hemp feedstock. It doesn't send the raw data to Canada.
It trains itself locally.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The local AI model learns the new behavior. Then it only sends the weights, the mathematical adjustments to the neural network, to node 2 in Canada.
Oh, wow.
Node 2 aggregates these learnings and pushes a tiny encrypted update out to the entire global mesh. So node 4 encounters a problem, learns how to fix it locally, and instantly teaches the rest of the network how to recognize and neutralize that specific threat.
That is wild. The entire ecosystem is a distributed cognitive mesh. If one node is attacked or fails, the intelligence dynamically routes around it. It's not just a grid, it's an immune system.
It really is.
And when you look at the deployment timeline in these audits, we are on the cusp of a massive expansion. Coming up in Q3 of this year, so August and September of 2026, they are rolling out South American tests in the high-altitude, low-oxygen environments of the Andes.
Right. They want to see how the server cooling fans hold up when the air is physically thinner and provides less convective cooling.
Makes sense. They're also deploying to the Asia-Pacific to test humidity corrosion resistance and how well the nodes can bond over satellite connections on remote islands.
If we pull back and look at the macro implications of this timeline, what DeReticular is building is the physical foundation for a truly global decentralized network state.
Mm.
They are creating an infrastructure backbone that does not rely on any single country's political stability, their centralized power grid, or their telecommunications monopolies.
Yeah.
By September of 2026, all 8 Project Octagon nodes will be physically on-site, fully powered, and communicating across 4 continents.
Okay, so we've established the architecture. We have this indestructible chainmail mesh of nodes scattered across the most hostile environments on Earth, communicating via federated AI. But this brings up the most glaring physical question.
How do they run?
Right. If these nodes are completely severed from the national grid, how exactly are they keeping the lights on? I mean, how do you power a 10-megawatt industrial park in Uganda without a transmission line connecting you to a coal plant or a massive hydroelectric dam?
That requires us to examine the heavy industrial hardware division of DeReticular, which they refer to as the heart of the node. This is a division called AgriDot Energy, and they manufacture what are called sovereign power systems, or SPS units.
And the sources are incredibly specific about a brand distinction here. They bold and underline this in the audits. AgriDot Energy, the DeReticular division, is not the Wisconsin-based company called AgriEnergy Corp.
That distinction is critical because the underlying physics are entirely different. The Wisconsin company utilizes biological digestion. They use microbes to break down organic dairy waste into methane gas. It is a biological process.
Right.
AgriDot Energy, on the other hand, utilizes Generation 2 high-temperature thermal plasma gasification. We are moving from biology to pure physics.
And this is where the engineering gets wild. The technical specs state that this isn't incineration. They aren't just burning trash in a giant furnace. They're using something called molecular dissociation.
Let's break down the mechanics of that because it is the linchpin of their entire energy independence model. To understand molecular dissociation, you have to look at the energy states of matter. You have solids, liquids, gases, and then you have plasma, the fourth state of matter. The sovereign power systems operate using a high-energy plasma arc, similar to a massive continuous lightning bolt inside a sealed chamber.
And the temperatures they are hitting are staggering. The documents say they operate at over 1,500 degrees Celsius, which is over 2,700 degrees Fahrenheit. The quality assurance tests even push them to 1,800 degrees Celsius.
At those extreme temperatures, the traditional rules of combustion do not apply. Combustion requires oxygen to fuel a fire, which creates smoke and ash. In a plasma gasification chamber, there is very little oxygen.
Wait, so there's no fire?
Exactly. When you feed matter into that 1,500 degree plasma field, you aren't burning it. The thermal energy is so intense that the plasma acts as a molecular scissor. It literally rips apart the atomic bonds of whatever you feed into it. It shatters the molecules into their basic elemental components.
So if you throw an old rubber tire into the system, it doesn't catch fire and produce thick black smoke. The heat just pulls the carbon and the hydrogen atoms apart from each other.
Exactly, because there is no burning, there are no smokestacks, there is no toxic ash drifting into the local atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And because it breaks matter down at the atomic level, the system is completely feedstock agnostic. It doesn't care what you feed it, as long as it contains carbon and hydrogen.
The intake list in the catalog is just everything you can imagine a town wanting to get rid of. They process hemp waste, municipal solid waste, just everyday town garbage, agricultural residues, old rubber tires, medical waste, and non-recyclable plastics.
Yeah.
You just feed this industrial beast whatever liability your town produces.
And what emerges from that molecular association is highly valuable. The primary output is continuous. 247 baseload electricity.
Which is huge.
It is a crucial detail because it solves the fatal flaw of renewable microgrids. Wind and solar power are intermittent. You are entirely dependent on the weather, which requires massive, expensive battery banks to match the gaps. With an SPS unit, you don't wait for the sun to shine. You just keep feeding the reactor the pound's waste to generate steady, reliable power.
But the electricity is just the beginning. The byproducts of this molecular shattering are fascinating. When the carbon and hydrogen atoms recombine as they tool, they form syngas.
Yes, synthesis gas. It is a highly purified mixture of hydrogen and carbon monoxide. Syngas is an incredibly potent, clean-burning fuel that can be used to run specialized turbines or internal combustion engines to generate that electricity.
Right, and what about the stuff that doesn't turn into gas?
Ah, right. As for the solid, inorganic material that goes into the reactor, say, the metal wire inside a rubber tire, or the glass and dirt in municipal garbage, that doesn't become gas. At 1,500 degrees, it melts into a liquid slag.
And when it cools, it turns into vitrified slag. The photos in the audit look like chunks of obsidian from a fantasy novel. It's this inert, non-toxic, shiny glass rock. The heavy metals are permanently locked inside the glass matrix so they can't leach into groundwater, and they actually use this slag as an aggregate material to pave roads.
It creates a perfectly circular physical economy. You take hazardous waste and turn it into baseload power and road infrastructure. But they go one step further with an optional engineering module called the micro-GTL, or gas-to-liquid synthesis reactor.
The chemistry on this is amazing. It takes the excess syngas that isn't being used for electricity and runs it through a Fischer-Tropsch process.
The Fischer-Tropsch process is actually a fascinating piece of chemical history. It was invented in Germany in the 1920s to turn coal gas into liquid fuel because they lacked domestic oil reserves.
Interesting.
Derriticular has miniaturized and modernized this process for the Edge. The micro-GTL module uses specialized cobalt or iron catalysts. When the syngas passes over these catalysts at specific temperatures and pressures, the carbon and hydrogen atoms stitch themselves back together into long hydrocarbon chains.
Meaning they are synthesizing their own liquid fuel out of thin air and garbage.
Yeah.
The catalog lists agri-synthetic diesel, which is a zero-sulfur fuel they use for their agricultural machinery, and agri-jet, which is aviation-grade kerosene used to fuel their autonomous drone fleets. And they sell these systems at various scales. The catalog starts with an entry-level 500-kilowatt system for $3.5 million, scaling all the way up to the SPS 10MW Titan, which costs $48 million and is physically massive, designed to replace municipal utilities entirely.
But having a machine that can vaporize trash into electricity and jet fuel is only half the battle of establishing true energy independence.
Right.
The ultimate test of a sovereign system is what happens when it completely dies. This raises an important engineering question. If your town's node goes completely offline, zero power, zero grid connection, how does a dead node resurrect itself without any external electrical help?
The sources detail a protocol for this called the Black Start. It is the ultimate tactical sequence. And reading through the operator's manual, it plays out like a high-tension thriller. Let's walk through this 15-minute red card sequence. Imagine the grid has totally collapsed. It's pitch black. Zero power anywhere in the region. Walk me through the first 5 minutes.
Okay, so the first 5 minutes are entirely about digital fortification. Before the operator even attempts to generate power, their first step is isolation.
Right, because you're vulnerable.
Exactly. They physically disconnect the wide area network and the satellite backhaul cables. When a highly complex system is booting up from zero, it is at its most vulnerable to cybernetic intrusion. By air-gapping the node, they ensure the local system cannot be jammed or sabotaged from the outside. Once digitally sealed, they physically verify the valves and thermal containment of the sovereign power system.
Okay, so minutes 5 to 10. This is the ignition phase. And this is where you realize the scale of this machinery. You can't just pull a ripcord to start a plasma reactor.
No, definitely not.
They use something called the Sovereign Reserve 1000. It's a massive 1 megawatt hour lithium iron phosphate battery bank. It is sitting there solely for this moment. The operator discharges this massive battery just to get the plasma arc torches hot enough to spark and stabilize.
And once the torches fire and the internal temperature begins to rise, the digital resurrection begins. The operator takes a physical encrypted master key USB and inserts it directly into the chassis of the main AI server, the Ryo CC1000.
Just right into the hardware.
Right into the hardware. They hold a physical reset button on the server shell for 10 seconds. Because there are no monitors powered on yet, they are listening for a specific motherboard beep code. 3 short beeps, 1 long beep.
And that's the signal.
Yes. That auditory signal confirms that the digital brain has successfully posted, completed its power on self-test, and the local control logic is active.
And finally, minutes 10 to 15. The thermal mass of the plasma reactor crosses that critical 1500 degree threshold. Once the heat stabilizes and the syngas begins to flow, the steam and gas turbines spool up and take over the electrical load. The system gracefully disconnects from the startup battery and becomes entirely self-sustaining.
At that exact moment, the software takes over. The operator digitally broadcasts an emergency SOS beacon to establish a localized mesh network via radio frequency, and the server spins up decentralized applications.
Wow.
They launch local instances of Matrix for encrypted, off-grid community messaging, and Nextcloud for local data storage and file sharing. In exactly 15 minutes, the community goes from the Stone Age to a fully powered, digitally connected, self-sustaining microgrid.
It is brilliant engineering, but let's take a step back.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about running a 1500-degree plasma reactor, high-pressure steam turbines, and advanced Fischer-Tropsch chemical refineries. Isn't this wildly dangerous for a small rural farming community to operate? You can't just deliver a plasma reactor to a local farmer's co-op, hand them the keys, and wish them luck. The liability would be astronomical.
It would be a catastrophe, and Dereticular is acutely aware of this. This is where they integrate the human element. They recognized a massive gap in human capital required for this transition, a gap they refer to as the Altimus bottleneck.
Right.
To solve this bottleneck safely, they established the Dereticular Academy. A community cannot legally purchase or operate this hardware unless they have certified sovereign power technicians, or SPTs, on staff.
And the training protocols detailed in the audit are rigorous.
Incredibly rigorous. They utilize a pedagogical system called the Safety Gate. Because it is too dangerous for novices to learn on live plasma reactors, students train on a highly advanced physics-based virtual reality simulator called AgriSim.
Oh, very cool.
But here's the critical catch. Students cannot even unlock the advanced simulator modules, the ones that teach you how to optimize syngas flow or manage the micro refinery pressures, until they pass the foundational high voltage safety and thermodynamic containment exam with a 100% perfect score.
So there's no grading on a curve here?
None. There is no passing with a B minus when you are dealing with 1500 degree plasma. If you don't understand the safety protocols flawlessly, the software simply denies you access to the operational training. You either understand the physics of containment perfectly, or you do not touch the machine.
Okay, turning local trash into 24/7 power, road aggregate, and jet fuel is incredible physics. But the physical hardware for the flagship 1-megawatt system costs $5.9 million. The Titan is $48 million. A farming co-op or a rural town doesn't have that kind of capital sitting in a checking account. Unless, well, the machine somehow pays for itself.
Exactly. And that is where the physics turn into economics. Dereticular hasn't just engineered a physical power plant. They have engineered a self-liquidating economic engine. They call this blueprint the digital flywheel.
The flow of the digital flywheel is fascinating. Local waste goes into the reactor. Continuous electricity comes out. But instead of just routing that electricity to power streetlights or homes, the excess electricity powers something called a Ryo's compute cluster.
Right.
That cluster generates digital token revenue and AI compute sales, which pays off the cost of the machine, eventually resulting in an asset-free, fully owned facility for the town.
Let's look at the physical brain of this operation first, because it is an engineering marvel in its own right. The Ryo's CC1000 Edge Compute Cluster. This isn't a standard, delicate server rack you'd find in a pristine, climate-controlled Silicon Valley data center.
No, not at all.
It is designed to sit next to a plasma reactor in kinetic, high-threat environments. Agricultural dust, industrial ash, high-vibration environments, extreme heat. These factors would destroy normal IT equipment in hours.
The physical fortifications on these servers are hardcore. The chassis features an IP67 exoshell, which acts as a heavy-duty aluminum Faraday cage. It completely seals out dust and moisture, and it protects the delicate internals from electromagnetic pulses or extreme solar flares. But if it's completely sealed, how do they cool the processors? There are no exterior fans to suck in fresh air, because that would suck in agricultural dirt.
They engineered a positive pressure cycle. Internal blowers and heat exchangers keep the air pressure inside the sealed case slightly higher than the atmospheric pressure outside.
Oh, that makes sense.
Because the internal pressure is higher, the chassis is constantly exhaling air through microscopic one-way valves, literally blowing dust and debris away from its seams. It uses thermodynamics to repel physical contaminants.
And the data integrity protocols enforce human discipline at the hardware level. The audits detail the blue LED protocol for the hot swappable NVMe memory blades. If the status light on a memory blade is flashing blue, it means the system is actively writing data to the drive.
And you do not want to touch it.
Right. If an impatient technician pulls the blade while it's flashing, it causes terminal drive corruption. You can only extract a memory blade when the LED turns solid blue, indicating the write cache has been fully flushed to disk.
So you have this indestructible, climate-resilient AI server sitting next to a plasma reactor on a farm. But how does this coupling actually generate revenue to pay off a multi-million dollar loan?
Here's where it gets really interesting. This is where we get into cryptographic monetization. The documents outline the Carbon Oracle. Every Agra.energy system integrates ZK Verify sensors directly into its physical flow meters.
Let's break down ZK Verify because that sounds like crypto jargon, but it is a complex cryptographic concept that makes this entire economy possible. ZK stands for zero knowledge proof. It is a way to mathematically prove that a statement is true without revealing the underlying data that makes it true.
Right. The classic analogy is the Where's Waldo puzzle.
Oh, yeah.
If we are looking at a Where's Waldo book, and I want to prove to you that I know exactly where Waldo is on the page, but I don't want to show you his exact location so I don't ruin the game for you, I can take a giant piece of black cardboard, cut a tiny hole in it, and place it over the book so that only Waldo is visible through the hole. I have mathematically proven to you that I know his location without revealing the coordinates of the rest of the page.
That is a brilliant analogy. Now apply that cryptographic principle to a physical power plant. The ZK Verify sensors physically measure the tons of garbage going into the reactor, they measure the carbon sequestered in the vitrified slag, and they measure the exact wattage of electricity being produced.
Okay, so it's tracking everything.
Everything. The sensors hash this data at the hardware level and broadcast a zero-knowledge proof to the blockchain. They mathematically prove, beyond a shadow of a doubt without revealing proprietary operational data, that the electricity being generated is carbon negative.
And because that green energy is mathematically verified by the blockchain in real time, the system automatically mints tradable, verified green compute credits. These aren't just conceptual. They're classified as real-world assets, or RWAs.
Yes. And the economic management of these assets is handled entirely by a localized AI, which Dare Reticular calls the Remnant. The Remnant acts as an autonomous hedge fund manager for the community's energy, utilizing an algorithm called spark spread arbitrage.
Spark spread arbitrage. It sounds intimidating, but the logic is incredibly elegant.
Ah.
The AI is constantly monitoring both the global digital markets and the local physical needs of the town, calculating the most profitable action second by second.
Exactly. The AI analyzes the variables and asks, we have a surplus of 5 megawatts of power right now. What is the highest value use of this energy?
Right. What's the best move?
Should I route this electricity to the local rural hospital because their demand is spiking? Should I send it to the micro GTL refinery to synthesize diesel for the tractors tomorrow because agricultural fuel prices are up? Or if the global AI and crypto markets are peaking, should I route this excess energy directly into our own Ryo servers to train global AI models, mine digital tokens, and earn pure cash?
It is a thermodynamic arbitrage engine. It converts wasted physical energy into high-value digital scarcity. And the timing of this deep dive is critical. As we speak, this month, July 2026, Dear Reticular is launching their RWA Marketplace mainnet.
That's a huge milestone.
This means these carbon-negative compute credits are no longer theoretical or illiquid. They become instantly tradable on global financial markets for stablecoins like USBC.
If we look at the macro environment, this is a masterful arbitrage of the current global AI power crisis. Right now, in 2026, the hyperscalers, the massive big tech companies building global AI models, are desperate for electricity. The centralized legacy grid cannot physically build transmission lines or nuclear plants fast enough to feed these massive data centers.
Yeah, they are starving for power.
Dear Reticular is bypassing the grid entirely. By combining rural waste management with high-density, decentralized compute, these farming nodes can generate the exact kind of verifiable carbon-negative power that big tech is legally mandated to buy for their corporate ESG requirements.
The philosophy underpinning this section is profoundly disruptive. The farm, is the new power plant. They're arguing that agriculture's primary export is shifting. It's not just about exporting corn and soybeans anymore. It's about exporting energy and high-density compute. A rural town's biggest financial liabilities, paying to haul away municipal waste and paying sky-high utility bills to a centralized grid, are completely flipped. The garbage becomes the free fuel that prints the digital money that pays off the $5 million machine.
It creates a self-liquidating asset. The infrastructure pays for itself through autonomous digital labor.
So we've built an autonomous power plant that pays for itself, and we have an AI brain that relentlessly trades the energy for profit. But how does this actually integrate into the daily physical lives of the people living around it? That brings us to the final major piece of the architecture, the muscle and the interface. Decentralized community autonomy.
This is where we see what Diverticular calls the Velcro principle in action. The Velcro principle is an engineering philosophy that dictates that value is maximized when you thermodynamically couple different industries together. Think about how a traditional data center operates. They generate massive amounts of heat. The legacy model views that heat as a liability, spending millions of dollars and megawatts of power on air conditioning just to vent that hot air into the atmosphere.
It is a massive waste of joules. Under the Velcro principle, that heat is categorized as an asset. The high-velocity exhaust heat radiating off those Ryo servers is captured through heat exchangers and piped directly into agrivoltaic greenhouses to grow food year-round in freezing climates. Or it is piped into thermal water distillation systems to purify local groundwater.
It's thermodynamics as economics. You are squeezing every possible drop of utility out of a single joule of energy. You use it to compute data, then you use the physical byproduct of that computation to grow tomatoes.
And then there is the logistics layer, curb cars. The documents insist these are not just electric cars, they refer to them as physical packet routers.
It is a brilliant reframing of mobility. Just as the internet routes packets of digital data securely and autonomously from node to node, curb cars autonomously route physical payloads, whether that is food, medicine, synthetic fuel, or human passengers, through the physical mesh of the community. And they operate completely off-grid through a mechanism called the Infinite Loop Protocol.
The Infinite Loop Protocol is mind-blowing machine-to-machine autonomy. Imagine a heavy-duty curb car, a model they call a mule. The AI dispatches the mule out into a local hemp field. It loads up tons of agricultural biomass and autonomously hauls it back to the agroplasma reactor.
Right.
The reactor uses molecular dissociation to vaporize that hemp, generating baseload electricity. That electricity is then routed to wireless charging pads to recharge the exact same mule that just delivered the fuel. The machine harvests the fuel to feed the engine that charges the machine. Humans don't even have to touch the process.
And because these machines are operating autonomously in human spaces, physical security is paramount. In a decentralized off-grid community, traditional access controls like brass keys or typed passwords are a massive liability. Keys can be stolen, passwords can be phished. Deoceris, the governance division of Diverticular, manages the physical experience layer using a technology called radio frequency fingerprinting, or RFF.
They are completely deprecating QR codes and passwords.
Yes, because software can be easily hacked, and a QR code is just an image that can be screenshotted and copied. RF fingerprinting relies on the physical imperfections of hardware. Silicon manufacturing is not perfect. At the microscopic level, every single radio transmitter in a smartphone or a digital passport has tiny variations in its crystal lattice. These microscopic analog flaws create a highly unique radio wave signature, a fingerprint.
So when you walk up to a facility door, or approach an autonomous curb car, the sensors analyze the microscopic analog flaws in the Bluetooth radio of your phone. It is an unspoofable hardware signature. The doors simply unlock when a verified radio wave approaches. You don't tap a card. You just exist in the space with a verified device.
They're actually running this seamless integration live right now in Kabang, Uganda, under a model they call Sovereign Hospitality. Tourists can book an eco-safari at Node 4. They stay in eco-pods made from hempcrete. But the entire resort is an active, revenue-generating node in the digital flywheel. The municipal waste the tourists produce during their stay is fed directly into the plasma reactor. That power runs the resort's amenities, and while the tourists are sleeping at night, the excess energy powers the AI compute cluster.
The revenue generated by that compute while the tourists sleep actually subsidizes the cost of the trip and pays the local Ugandan staff significantly higher wages. It is a completely regenerative economic loop. The mere act of visiting the location funds its ongoing infrastructure.
And because these rural nodes are physically isolated, heavily fortified, and fully encrypted, they are also being positioned as data vaults in the cornfield. As global data privacy laws become more draconian and centralized servers become prime targets for state-sponsored hacks, these sovereign nodes are becoming the most secure, uncensorable data havens on Earth.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
They utilize a dynamic security protocol called the Watchtower. The local AI constantly stands the RF environment, categorizing local devices into green, gray, or red lists based on their radio signatures, isolating and ignoring any hostile jammers instantly.
And if someone attempts a physical kinetic breach of the server hardware, say, someone tries to pry open the chassis of the RIO server with a crowbar to steal the drives, it triggers the scorched earth key purge.
This is a defense against cold boot attacks. In a cold boot attack, a hacker physically freezes a RAM stick to preserve the data states, then extracts it to read the encryption keys. To prevent this, the RIO server chassis has a pressurized physical tamper seal.
If that physical seal is broken, without the system first being placed into authorized maintenance mode, a circuit breaks, dropping the voltage across a specific chip to zero. The system instantly, irreversibly purges all encryption keys from the volatile RAM. Every single piece of data stored locally becomes permanently unreadable in a fraction of a second. The hard drives become encrypted bricks. It is literal defense-grade security sitting in a barn in the middle of a cornfield.
All of this complex automation culminates in a massive upcoming stress test. In October of this year, 2026, Deriticular is initiating what they call the Rural Turing Test at Node 3 in Arizona.
The AI is going to take the wheel completely. For a full 24 hours, the local remnant AI will attempt to manage the node's entire physical and digital economy. It will decide when to run the plasma reactor based on local waste levels, how to trade the generated power on the crypto markets, when to dispatch the curb cars for logistics, and how to balance the thermal loads of the servers with absolutely zero human input, which begs an incredibly profound question. If the curb cars are driving themselves, the remnant AI is trading the electricity and managing the economics, and the plasma reactor is running on an infinite loop, feeding itself, what is left for the humans to actually do?
Right.
Are we just pets in this scenario, lounging in greenhouses while the machines run the town?
Not at all, but it requires a profound philosophical shift in how we view the concept of labor. Deriticular is aiming to transition humans from being laborers who perform mechanical maintenance to becoming what they call sovereign systems architects. When humans are finally freed from the daily grinding mechanics of basic survival, chopping wood, paying the electric company, hauling away trash, driving trucks, their cognitive capital is elevated.
We move from maintenance to governance.
Precisely. Humans become responsible for writing the digital constitutions of their communities. They map out the parameters of the circular economies. They act as sovereign stewards, voting via decentralized autonomous organizations, or BAOs, to decide how the community's autonomously generated wealth is allocated.
Yeah.
The machines generate the profit. The humans debate whether that compute revenue should be used to build a new agrivoltaic greenhouse, fund a local medical clinic, or pay a universal basic income to the residents. It elevates human interaction to strategy and community building.
Okay, we have covered a staggering amount of ground today. We started by looking at the fragile linear dependencies of the 1,000-mile grid we all currently rely on, and how Project Octagon is systematically replacing it with a resilient, self-healing spherical mesh. We took a deep dive into the 1,500-degree plasma heart of the AgriDot energy node, explaining how molecular dissociation vaporizes waste into clean baseload power and synthetic fuel. We unpacked the digital flywheel, explaining how that continuous power runs heavily fortified AI servers to mint zero-knowledge cryptographic credits, literally creating a system that pays for the town's infrastructure. And we looked at a future where autonomous curb cars and localized DAO governance create a completely circular, thermodynamically efficient, sovereign community.
It is a comprehensive, deeply engineered blueprint for total local independence.
I want you, listening right now, to look around your own neighborhood today. Look at the garbage can sitting on the curb. Where is that waste actually going? And how much is your town paying to move it? Look at the power line strung above your street. Where is that power coming from? How quickly would your neighborhood's supply chain, communication, and heat fail if a transmission line 1,000 miles away was suddenly severed?
The vulnerability of our current system is everywhere once you learn to see the invisible lines.
I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over, something buried deep in the governance section of these documents regarding the Liquidus Ledger. That ledger immutably tracks every machine action, every watt of power, and every piece of human labor on a local blockchain. If a decentralized community becomes entirely self-sufficient, generating its own clean power, growing its own food in climate-controlled greenhouses, managing its own autonomous logistics fleets, and securing its own uncensorable data, and all of their actions are governed autonomously by their own AI-managed smart contracts, what happens when the laws of their local digital constitution conflict with the laws of the legacy nation-state they geographically reside in? Are these just fancy microgrids? Or are we witnessing the silent technological birth of sovereign physical nations?
That is the ultimate question this technology forces us to answer.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into Project Octagon. Keep questioning the grid around you and keep exploring. Until next time.